Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
I'd actually seen one or two of them, but not in these numbers and certainly not when we're operating on a day-to-day business. So it was quite nice to see them in a different environment and actually seeing them moving and not seeing them in a kind of air show environment, you know, and even look inside some of them. So, it was brilliant. And of course, Antonov-24s, I'd never seen one of those before. And then you have other things, so Antonov-26s, Antonov-32s. But then even the older stuff, Antonov-2s, I'd seen a handful before I went out to Siberia, and then I ended up seeing, you know, several hundred of them.
Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to this latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Graham Rendell has appeared several times on Extended to talk about such diverse topics as unidentified aerial phenomenon and the history of RAF Morpeth. On both occasions, these episodes proved really popular, and on each episode, we teased you with a mention of a plane spotting trip Graham made to Russia in 1992, 6 months after the fall of the Iron Curtain. A trip that, even till today, has never been repeated. Graham is back to tell us all about the journey recorded in his book, To the Ends of the Earth, A Snapshot of Aviation in Northeastern Siberia in Summer 1992. Graham, well, welcome back to Extended.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me back. Good to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you back. The book's a real gem. It's a real gem. It's a nugget of history that maybe because of my age was an absolutely fascinating read. But as I mentioned before I hit record there, the book is also constructed in a unique way. Not only have you got the story of this journey, which we'll talk about in a moment, but you've got the chronology of every airframe that you've got a photo in the book for. And I was fascinated by the history of some of those aircraft and airframes. Why did you go about constructing the book the way that you did?
Well, this is my first book, and I did think about how to approach the subject of, you know, telling the story of my travels around Siberia. And some other magazine articles that I'd written years ago, even before this book, I wanted them to be sort of appreciated through multiple audiences, so it wasn't just aimed at one particular group of people, because you're narrowing your focus too much there, and you want to get as many people as possible to read your book. I mean, that's why you write them, really. So I wanted to appeal to people who looked at it as a travelogue, and it was merely just, you know, somebody's trip around Siberia. I wanted it also for people who wanted to know more about the area itself, but also people who looked at pictures, because there's quite a lot of pictures in the book as well, but also for the number crunchers, for the spotters, for the people who thrive on the facts and figures and the numbers. And so each photograph, basically the caption is the history of the aeroplane that's being depicted. So yeah, that's where your three bits of, you know, the audience are. And hopefully, you know, all three sections will enjoy the book for the different ways, but yeah, people might also enjoy all three aspects of it as well, and they might come across things that they would never have normally sort of read but actually appreciate. So you've got the people who just like the travelogue side might actually delve into the history of the aeroplanes and find that really fascinating, and vice versa, of course. So, yeah, that's the reason I pitched it that way.
And it's a real hidden gem of a book.
Thank you.
And I really, really say that genuinely. I really enjoyed it. It taught me a lot about geography, history. There's some fascinating statistics in there. You talk about every airfield you go to, the history. But as you say, you've also got that travel log, so you feel part of the journey that you went on. But without doubt, the stars of the show and why we're here is to talk about some of the airfields and airframes that you stumbled across that even to this day, most people listening to this will never have seen except in photos. And even some of those are quite rare. But let's take us all the way back to 1992. And to put this in context, tell us about the timing of that politically and historically.
Yeah, so December 91 is when basically the Soviet Union ceased to be. It was something like the 26th or the 28th when it got dissolved, if you like. It became the Russian Federation. And it was a curious time as well, because the Soviet Union was on its last legs, you know, even months and years before that. It was just the writing was on the wall. And of course, when Ceausescu's, sort of regime fell in Romania, and then you had the fall of the wall, it was only kind of like the, it was only going to be sort of a matter of time before the Soviet Union just fell apart, and it did. And of course, things opened up then. It wasn't immediately obvious that you could actually get around Russia as much as you could, as we could, 6 months afterwards. But the chinks were there, and people were already traveling anyway. And there was some people who actually managed to get into Russia quite early on in 1992. But, I actually sort of saw an advert in Aeroplane Monthly, believe it or not, I think it was December 1991. So it was around about the time that the Soviet Union ceased to be, advertising this trip. And it was Alpha Mike Tours, which I'm not entirely sure is still going, but it was Andy Marsh, a guy who I believe was an air traffic controller based at Swanwick. And he was, like most kind of these travel firms like Aeroprints and all the rest of them, probably a lot of people listening to this would know from back then, mostly engaged in running trips to parts of Europe, like West Europe, Western Europe, but also to America. So they had a list of people who would go, because quite a lot of people used to go on these trips. I knew a lot of people in Newcastle who would go on various trips, but they were the people who had money, or time or both. I had neither, but I managed to scrape enough money to get this trip because it was something like £1,200, which for back in those days was quite a lot of money. Wow. Half of which apparently was on the airfare to get to Moscow and back, and the rest of it was to do with the organizing these airplanes and the bribes, because they had had a fixer or numerous fixers who had to get things sorted out with the local bureaucrats in advance of the trip. And then it was all put together, probably on a shoestring, but also flying by the seat of your pants kind of thing. A lot could go wrong, and actually did. And a lot of things that apparently were promised or suggested that was part of the itinerary to start with never happened for one reason or another. But what did happen was, as far as I was concerned, was absolutely brilliant. I was absolutely gobsmacked. Still, what was it achieved? 6 months after the fall of the fall of Soviet Union, basically.
What was the promise, Graham? What was it that got your appetite so wet by this? Because, let's go back. That's a lot of money in those days, particularly for a mid-20s young lad. Mm-hmm. That was a lot of money. What was it that really got your appetite before you decided to go?
I actually write about this in my introduction. As a kid, and I'm talking about somebody who's maybe 5 or 6 or maybe a little bit older, I found myself scribbling in my grandmother's Reader's Digest World Atlas. I mean, people have seen this, the big green cover book and all these kind of pictures of maps around the world. And I remember scribbling this line across Siberia in this big loop, thinking I'm going to go there one day, not knowing the kind of geopolitics of everything and even at that age. But then, sort of as I got older, I was really interested in kind of, what was happening behind the Iron Curtain, because it was completely unknown. And it was a different political system, with different military systems, different social system. I guess I wasn't that involved with the politics of it back in those days, but I was just curious, like a lot of kids, don't know what's on the other side of the hill kind of thing. And being interested in aviation from an early age, I would read things like Air International, which had really good breakdowns of the latest Soviet fighters, but also of the earlier ones, so the ones from the 50s and 60s, like the Sukhoi Su-15 Flagon, which I would actually come up close and personal with when I was in Siberia. So, these kind of aircraft that I was only reading about in the pages of fairly limited run kind of publications back in the 70s and the 1980s, I would eventually see them in the flesh, so to speak. So this kind of thing that I was really interested in back in those days, and never lost that enthusiasm for what was happening on the other side of the Iron Curtain. When the chance came along to go, you know, look, you can go and see these places. You know, I only ever saw Moscow on a BBC news bulletin when you would see, you know, Gorbachev or Andropov or Brezhnev standing on the, on the balcony or on that kind of walkway, that reviewing stand for the May Day parades, you know, or you'd see some other kind of footage of the Kremlin. You know, those kind of, it was just something on a TV screen. And then you got new. I would listen to Radio Moscow on shortwave occasionally because I had a shortwave set, and it was all this. And it was propaganda, and I knew that on a level. But it was, again, it was just added to the kind of intrigue and the kind of mystery of what was happening out there. And there was the old jokes about, you know, there's like 200 people died in a ferry accident on the Volga kind of thing, and you know, you get like two lines in Pravda. It was all this kind of like just mythology that built up about this huge country of that, you know, a lot of which was almost totally uninhabited. And yet here was an opportunity to go and see it. And not just go and see it as a tourist, but also go and see it from an aviation point of view. So everything came together, and it was just like, yeah, I'm, you know, I don't care how much it is, how much I'm going to have to dive into my savings, I want to go. And and that was it, basically, Peter. I was already part of a group called Air North at that time in Newcastle, and I cast around through the people who I knew there to see, would anybody go with me? Because otherwise I was going to go on my own. And everybody went, oh, I'm not going there kind of thing. It was like, you're mad?
So
I couldn't persuade anybody. I think it was a case of where it was and how much it was, and possibly just, you know, people were going other places, because people were quite comfortable then going to America to see airplanes. They were quite comfortable about going around, you know, Germany and Italy and all the rest of it. But Russia was probably terra incognita, and especially just, you know, it was still the bogeyman, I guess, in many people's their eyes. So yeah, it was a kind of a bridge too far in terms of, oh yeah, we'll want to go there. But when this trip came along and I saw it, that was me sold. You know, they could have charged twice it and I would have still found the money for it. So
yeah. And then culturally, without jumping the gun too much here, culturally, it really still was very much like a Soviet Union structure, certainly security and all the challenges around it. And as you mentioned, things like fixers. Getting to Moscow was quite traditional, you know, British Airways 767 or whatever
it was.
Quite a traditional route. But I think as soon as you got to the checkpoints and customs, you started to feel the culture shift.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you had the border guards with the military uniforms on and the epaulettes with the Cyrillic writing. So it was a kind of strange, you know, sort of alphabet straight away. And then you were in this kind of zone, this marked off zone in front of the booth, and you have this soldier behind this antiquated computer, screen and keyboard that looked like something from from the 1950s and 1960s. It was ancient, and he was typing away on it, and it was, you know, green screen, huge CRT on it. It almost looked like smoke going to come out the back of it. And all the while, when he stopped typing, he would stare at you. And it was that kind of classic spy novel, you know, where you've seen these things where, you know, the security guards just try to stare out the good guy.
And
it was that kind of like, it must have only been like for 5 seconds, but it seemed like an absolute eternity.
Sure.
And he was just like inscrutable, but just going like this kind of thing, just staring at it. And it didn't matter, you know, hadn't done anything wrong, but you just really put you on the spot.
Yeah, really intense.
That kind of, am I going to find anything wrong with my passport? Are my papers going to be in order? Is my visa okay? Am I going to be hauled off to Lubyanka, into the prison in Moscow?
What were you warned about before you went? What did the guides tell you had to do, you didn't have to do, money?
Well, the stipulation was you can't take out more Western currency than you take in. So that was the main thing, really. And we actually warned about that on the plane. You had to declare how much Western currency you were taking in. You had to fill in a form in on the plane before you landed. Just on the descent into Moscow, we had to fill in this form.
Yeah.
And if you try to take out more, let's say, argument's sake, you won money at a casino or somebody give you some money for something, then, you know, they would have you. And there was a case of we saw somebody's luggage get taken apart because apparently they had more money, that they were trying to take out than they came in with. So that was one major thing. But of course, there's all the other things, like, you know, they had rules like you can't take pictures of the ground from an aeroplane. And that was a throwback to the Soviet days, where they had this kind of security situation. And of course, there was always that kind of, you know, overriding fear that we wouldn't be able to take pictures around the airports, even though we'd been like promised that wouldn't be the, you know, a problem, because the fixes had all sorted out. But, you know, you were never entirely sure. So it was a bit of a leap in the dark, basically. You know, the organizers through the fixers promised us this, that, and the other. But, you know, whether it was going to be a case of we turn up at the airport and that was it, that was the only thing we're ever going to see. And we might turn up places and then, you know, there was going to be like some KGB guys going to say, right, you're all spies, you know, we're arresting you all. It was, well, you know, we just didn't know.
And you had to take things with you, didn't you, to, let's just say, ease some of the decisions that had to be made.
You could say easing. I think the word you're searching for there is bribe. there was quite a lot of alcohol, as in champagne bottles, but a lot of cigarettes as well, that we had in the hold of the aeroplane that finally flew around Siberia. And that was part of the deal. So if things hadn't been sorted out beforehand, then we had a kind of ready stash of kind of, say, you know, well, because that's what they were, bribes, to try and smooth over things if the need arose. So, if we got ourselves into a situation where some local official or some bureaucrat, you know, couldn't get paid off, because also you could bung them some money as well, then we had all this stuff that would, you know, just sort, on the QT. And I think the organizer, the local fixers, and our interpreter were all in a kind of, you know, in cahoots in terms of knowing what the score was or having a fair idea through, you know, contact with the fixers. So all that was in the background. We weren't really privy to most of it until it sort of blew up in our faces at least one occasion. That side of things, I guess. In some ways, I was a bit naive in thinking, oh, yeah, we're just going to turn up, we're going to see a few aircraft, we're going to go home. You know, it was also a lot more going on behind the scenes than that. And obviously, I go into some of that in the book from what I heard about what happened and some of the things that I heard afterwards. It was clearly kind of flying by the seat of our pants around Siberia. And there was a lot that could have got wrong, which didn't. And some things that did go wrong, which we managed to survive. So, yeah.
What about the rest of the group? You were there particularly to photograph aircraft, weren't you? What other sort of people did you have on the in the group with you?
We had an interesting diverse range. So we had the committed spotters. There was a particular group from London. They must have been the Heathrow Brigade. And they were like sort of, you know, that was a religion for them. So everything that moved had to be catalogued. And they called and the one particular guy called, you've got to see the NOS. You know, that was his shorthand for the numbers, the NOS. And there was a few other people around who, some of them were legendary, apparently, for travelling. And the rest were a curious mix of some airline employees who were just interested in the subject and wanted to go and see Russia. There was a couple of people who were interested in the photographs, like me, and there were some people who literally just want to go for the experience. And there was a couple of pilots as well. Most of us were British, but there were a few Germans. There was a French guy. So it was quite a good mix.
Okay, well let's crack on and get ourselves through Moscow and start talking about some aeroplanes. Listen, we're never going to be able to cover every stop that you made, so we'll just do the best to give a flavour. But fascinated by the first. The arrival and positioning of your first aircraft, which was the main aircraft you were going to fly on. Do you just want to tell us about how that all came about and how you boarded and got off on your journey?
Yeah, so the aircraft, originally, actually, we were going to be flying all the way to Siberia and back in an Antonov 24. And that was simply not practical for the number of people who had the trip, plus all our luggage and the crew of the aircraft and the three ex-Aeroflot stewardesses who were bringing along as well, and all their gear. So it was never going to happen. So they had to get a bigger aircraft.
I think in context, Graham, sorry, just to interrupt you there, you have to understand the distances involved here are ginormous.
Fast.
You can look at a map and you can say, yeah, that's a long way, but it really, really is. And particularly when you're flying with a turboprop.
Exactly. So there was no way they were going to be able to fly to Siberia from Moscow in an An-24, and certainly not in the time available with all the gear that we had and all the people. So they had to get a bigger aircraft. So what they eventually managed to get a hold of was an Ilyushin 18. So that's a big four-engined turboprop aircraft. It dates from like the 50s. It was built in something like 57 or 58, this particular model. And it was 75466, which belonged to the Polar Aviation Directorate of Aeroflot. It had been used for iceberg spotting over the Arctic Ocean at one time. It was also used as a crew ferry. It was transporting gear and equipment and people and all the rest of it. And it used to fly regularly from Moscow out to Siberia, up to various places in Siberia. So it was well used to those kind of conditions. And it could get into reasonably short strips, but not obviously really tiny and dirt strips. But for our purposes, it was good enough to get across to like so Novosibirsk and Irkutsk and Yakutsk. But we couldn't get any further than that. We couldn't get into the hinterland. But that was ideal to get us there. And then we would hire on the spot. It was arranged to have Antonov 24s taking us to other places around the area. And that's what happened. But the Ilya 18 was brilliant. It was split up into like two particular passenger cabins. So you had the kind of bulk standard cattle class in the back, which had plastic seats, which was pretty rough. And ready. If anybody ever got on a chartered Ilya 18 to fly them off to Bulgaria or something back in the 70s and 80s, you know exactly what I mean. They were pretty rough. But in the front, beyond the middle section where you boarded the aircraft and you put all your big fur coats in this huge luggage area, then there was a VIP section, or that's what we called it, with nice, comfy kind of almost armchair sites. They weren't quite, but they were nice and comfy and padded, and you could lie full length across them over three seats and fall asleep. And this is mentioned in the book, but about 10, 15 minutes or 20 minutes or half an hour or something after we left Moscow Sheremetyevo 1, the pilot basically had a radio back to the cabin and say, we've got center of gravity problems. Everybody's sitting in the back. Can 10 people go up the front cabin? So, of course, I could have given a sprinter a run through his money, and that was straight out of the blocks and straight in there. So it was quite nice, actually, because the Germans, the French guy, and a couple of the airline people from Dan Air, and then a guy from Aberdeen who was really good as well. He could speak fluent Russian as well, really helped. We all basically became this little, like, kind of microcosm, this little group up front, and all the spotters and all the crazy, all the people who were just after the numbers, that's all they talked about. They were in the back. So it was a quite nice mix, So even though we still talked to them, there was like two distinct groups basically formed on this trip. But it was great. But that was the aircraft we ended up in. It was nice and comfortable as far as we were concerned at the front. We were right next to the cockpit. The door was open most of the time. We had an open invitation to go in and basically just stick our heads in and talk to them, even though they didn't have much English or any English at all. But if Rudy, our Hungarian Russian interpreter, was around, he would translate for us. So we did actually get to know quite a bit about what was happening, not just for the flight, but also for the history of the mechanic who was on board, who was ex-Soviet Air Force. So we used to get a few little tales from his time and some of the kind of state of some of the aeroplanes that they used to maintain. So it was quite nice, really. We had all this kind of conversations were going on, but also with the people who I was sitting with. So and we were mostly photographers as well. So it was quite a nice way to get
and
involved.
You mentioned the mechanic there. Most aircraft don't carry a mechanic. They might carry a flight engineer. They might carry a navigator. And a couple of pilots. What was the purpose of the mechanic?
In case it broke down. Basically, in case on the spot they needed an on the spot repair, because I think they couldn't guarantee that they could get something fixed where we ended up. And let's say, for argument's sake, we ended up somewhere where they didn't have some kind of arrangement in place, then there might have been problems in trying to get something sorted out. So they had somebody on board who could fix stuff. He had overalls on. He didn't seem to be flight crew. He did sit up there occasionally, but he was definitely a mechanic.
And I think you have to read the book to get a flavour for some of the places and the remoteness of some of the places you went to. So it is quite understandable.
Oh, yeah. Most of them, the places you can't get to by road, they don't have roads. The only way you can get to them is by air or by water if it's not frozen up. Or most of the times you could travel by barge to some of these places or by ice road. But in the autumn and the spring, when there's a melt or a thaw, or the freeze, when you know it's that kind of curious time in between a thaw, full thaw and a full freeze, they're completely unnavigable. So the only way was in by air, and a lot of places we went to.
Okay, you mentioned part route by the Aleutian 18, and then part route by the Antonov 24. Do you just want to give a flavour for the overall route that you took and where you went to, and then we can maybe start picking the bones some of the airframes.
Yeah, here's a whistle stop tour. So left Moscow, flew straight to Novosibirsk Tolmachevo, which is the main airport in Novosibirsk, the gateway to Siberia. We arrived there really late at night because of the time zones. Obviously, we're going forward in time, basically. Yeah. We landed there about midnight, had a stay in the hotel. We got carted off to, and then the next morning was a bus ride to the other side of the city to a place called Sevigny, which was a helicopter repair station. And there was this huge place with huge hangars with Mil-6 hooks, Mil-26 helos, you name it, every type of Soviet kind of era helicopter was there. And there was also a military site in the place as well, which the commander wouldn't let us around, but we could see everything from the other side of the airfield. We then got bussed back to the airfield, took off, saw a huge regiment of Su-15s parked on another part of the airfield, which we'd never seen, which we were never told about because it's the Soviet mentality still in play. We flew to Bratsk, to Krasnoyarsk. We had a trip around there, just a tour around the airfield. We then flew to Bratsk. We had a trip around the airfield there as well. And then off to Mirny, which is where this huge open cast diamond mine is. It's like this big hole in the ground. And that's where we stayed. And then we chartered a NAN-24 the next day to fly around five different gravel strips in that area, just to the south. And this is right in the middle of Siberia. And there's nothing around there. But these were mostly kind of former mining stations or some other types of industry where they would set up a town and have to have an airfield, if you like. And some of these places also were also what they called the Al-Sibir route, which is the Alaska Siberia route during World War II, when Lend-Lease aircraft were being delivered from Alaska to Moscow. They had to open a string of the airstrips. And some of these were now being used as local airports for some of these towns. So that's why they were built in the mid-40s. Anyway, so after we left Mirny, flew to Yakutsk. That's one of the major towns in northeastern Siberia on the River Lena. And then we got another, we had a tour around the airport there. I got quite sick for a morning with drinking too much prune juice, but there's another story. We then hired another, I think we stayed there a night, and then we had another, we had a trip from via bus to another airfield nearby called Magan, which was a kind of, had a few military aircraft on, but it was mostly civil aircraft, including a very, very bent Aleutian 62 airliner. That's another story. And then we got back in the air. We had another chartered N-24, a second one, which flew us up to the Arctic Ocean. So we were about an hour and a half flying time from Alaska at that point, and we ended up at a polar research station called Chersky, which is 60 miles from the coast. And it was where we would stay for a night as well. And that's where the cache of old IL-14 crates were. There was a whole stash of them up there, which never fly again. But there was one that would, and we were promised a flight in it, but it was, by the time we got there, it was unserviceable, and they couldn't get it to work. But we got a helicopter flight to see some aircraft which had been dumped on an island as well, so that was interesting. And then we flew to a place called Chokhodar, which is probably the coldest place ever, and that's even further north in Siberia, up towards Tixi, which is way in the Arctic north. It's cold most of the year. And that's a really miserable place, is Chokhodar. It's basically in a district the size of Wales with a population 2,500 for the whole area. And most of it's centered on this one town, on a river, and there's nothing else around for hundreds of miles in either direction. So that gives you an idea of what this place looks like. And the landscape is basically peat bog, moss, rivers, water, That's it. Very little else. Yeah. And this place was, I guess, hell on earth, really. You know, why you live there, God only knows. Why you work there, even worse. Why you went there, why we went there.
Well, there were some pretty impressive airframes, but
I'll just finish that. Yeah. So there's a couple of other places to go. Back in stages to Yakutsk, we flew to Irkutsk as well, which is down near Lake Baikal, and then flew directly back from there to Moscow. So that was the itinerary.
Wow. And sorry, I forget the how many thousands of kilometers that was.
I can't even remember myself.
But in context, I think the flight back to Moscow was
9.5 hours.
Yeah, 9.5 hours. Non-stop.
I think the pilots put put an alarm clock on top of the cockpit on the dashboard kind of thing and then fell asleep.
Yeah, I love that bit. And it woke them up just before descent into Moscow. And
Pretty much.
Given all the security things, you know, that existed at that time, it's just amazing, that story on its own right. But let's go back. By the way, I never knew an Ilyushin 18 could fly that long, but there you go. I think you use a term, basic but functional or something like that early on in the book. And I meant to make a note of that because I think that's what you found throughout the journey, you know, not built for comfort. But like the Antonov 24 on gravel strips, you know, does exactly what it needed to.
Oh, yeah. Functional.
Did you know that in the late 1940s, during atomic weapons testing in the Pacific, the USA used Boeing B-17 Flying Fortresses as unmanned radio-controlled drones? Did you also know that in 1927, two RAF officers in a Hawker Horsley set a new distance record, flying from Britain to the Persian Gulf, only for it to be eclipsed just hours later by Charles Lindbergh's Solo Atlantic crossing, which was a mere 180 miles longer? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
So let's talk about some of the airframes. I don't even know where to start. I was about a quarter of the way into the book, and I thought, that's got to have been it. There's surely, we're not going to beat it. Every chapter, something new came up. And I think it's fair to say I was very intrigued by many of the air lifters, the cargo aircraft, the volume of them, things like the lets parked all over the place, the number of abandoned aircraft, the number of aircraft, as you said, the Ilyushin 62 that had an unfortunate incident, so they just cut it up and dragged it back onto the airfield. I mean, it just was amazing. So
do you want to do that in a lot of airfields though, Peter? You'd end up somewhere and there'd be a wreck right next to the runway. And it was a case of literally they just dragged them off the runway and left them there. And they could have been there 20 years. And there was one that was there from 1976 in one particular place. You know, they just left it there. It was like a memorial almost on the side of the runway. It's like, what?
As I was reading it, I was thinking, gosh, I wish I was there. I wish I could just have one of those cockpit dials. I wish I could just have a window. I wish I could just have a switch. You know, it was just amazing. And much of them, as we mentioned earlier, you do their individual chronology and history, written in a way that, again, is not geeky. It's not just for the aeroplane addicts. I think a general reader that's looking for a travel log could read that about that aircraft and understand it. And again, to put that into context, we are talking, I don't know how many photos I saw, 100? Possibly?
200, something like 200, in the book. I think, in the book.
Yeah, of which I'd say 95%, you've got almost a full history of, and it's just a fascinating
room. There's a few aircraft people I just couldn't get any details on because there's literally nothing known about them. There's a couple I had to actually ask somebody in Siberia. I managed to get in contact with somebody who gave me some details on two particular airframes, which at the time, none of us knew what they were. We didn't even know what types they were because it was just completely off the wall.
There were a couple. So let's talk about some of those airframes. I don't even know where to start. Whether we do it by military, whether we do it by cargo, fighter bomber. I just don't even know.
Just pick one at random.
Yeah. Going backwards to come forwards, I want to talk about Moscow when you got back to Moscow, in a little bit. But tell us about some of the more remote places and what you saw, because I was so surprised that you were given such free access in the majority of the places you went to. Literally just walked the lines.
I think they just didn't know what to make of us. I think on one kind of like area, we were a novelty. It was the first time some of them had probably seen Westerners. And then the rest of it was just, well, what are they going to do? You know, they're not going to be able to like walk off with an aeroplane. Are they going to spy? Well, what are they going to see? You know, these aircraft are everywhere here. So I think we were a bit of a novelty. Looked like we were fairly harmless, and they must have just told people in advance, look, they're just here to see aeroplanes. So you can imagine these huge forests, the taiga in Siberia, and this endless, endless expanse of forest, or mountain ranges that just seem to go on forever, huge rivers, and then occasionally these towns and villages which are dotted here, there, and mostly on the rivers because that's the way they travel.
So you
would end up at one of these places, Nyoba. Let's pick that, for instance. It's a place in the middle of Siberia. I can't really go into much more detail than that. It's in the middle of nowhere. That'll give you an idea, your listeners an idea of where it was. To the south, it's to the south of Yakutsk, basically. Anyway, we turned up and it was a similar format to most of the other airfields we've been to on this little trip around these five airfields from Mirny. And we landed in the N24, on this gravel strip. And we taxied in, got off the airplane. There was a few airplanes lying around on the parking area in front of this ramshackle building that was the passenger terminal, such as it was. There was a few other ancillary buildings around, there were a few vehicles around, most of which have seen better days. There were a few, there was an N24 there, there was a few N2s, so they're everywhere anyway. So that was about it, and that was in a couple of helicopters. And that's what you normally saw at most of these strips. And yet somebody then said, oh, by the way, do you know we've got some other helicopters nearby? You've just got to walk out the airfield across this bridge, across a stream, and then you'll see this field. And we sort of like managed to arrange with the pilots and the crew that we had enough time to go and see this. So we all trooped off and we sort of got across this bridge and through this kind of gap in these trees or whatever. There was this huge field and there was about 20 Mil-6s.
Wow.
It was huge, heavy lift, cargo lift helicopters.
Yeah.
And they were just parked out. And apparently it turned out it was the major cargo helicopter base for the whole area, for the diamond mines, for the oil fields, you name it, for everywhere. So these helicopters supported all this kind of extraction business in this area of Siberia. So it was a kind of big focus, and that's why they had so many machines there. But, you know, you would never have known about it otherwise.
Yeah.
This is a pre-internet age, you've got to remember. You know, there's not a kind of satellite imagery. You can't see what's happening somewhere. Nobody's been there before, so we haven't got any kind of, you know, on the ground, information about what's happening. And nobody's going to tell you, you know, in advance, because that was the kind of Soviet way. They don't give information out willy-nilly. But somebody must have taken pity on us or thought, oh, they might be interested in this. One of the locals and said, so we all found these huge helicopters. And again, nobody stopped us walking around. It was like, just go and have a wander. And there was nobody there, though. That was the other thing. There was absolutely nobody on this huge field. And I'm talking about, it must have been several, maybe a dozen or so football pitches in size. It was enormous to walk around this area, and just little bits of concrete hard standing and helicopters plonked on top of them. If the doors had been open, we could have probably walked inside them, So,
and that wasn't an unfamiliar story in the book.
Not by any means.
You can if you've got any knowledge of Soviet airframes from the 70s, 80s and 90s, think of any one and Graham saw it pretty much. There were Coots there, there were everything. Yeah. As you say, Cubs by the hundreds.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Military and civilian, yeah. Most of the civilian ones had a military role anyway. In times of war, they would be called up for service. So a lot of them had gun turrets. But that's not new. I mean, most people in who have seen M12s will know they had a military role back then. But we saw some fairly rare ones, Elint versions as well as the bulk standard cargo ones, but also ones that were used by Aeroflot. Some which were in derelict condition, others which were in tip-top condition, and everywhere in between.
And looking at some other military ones, as I say, come back to it, because in Moscow you saw some foreign military hardware. I want to come back to that. But the one that stuck with me was the Tupolev 22s that you saw. I think peering over the wall trying to see if you could see them. Policemen driving past.
National Airport. It was across a dual carriageway, and there was this kind of huge concrete wall, and it was about 7 foot high. And you couldn't see what was on the top, apart from a few tails of airplanes. And we're sort of on the way in, a couple of people sitting next to the window of the aircraft had caught glimpses of maybe a few airframes out there. And so there was this kind of, should we go and have a look? Or maybe not, we shouldn't be walking around outside the airport where we're not, part of the group kind of thing. And a few of us brave souls kind of said, we'll just have a wander down, shall we? So we wandered out the airport, had a walk down the road, crossed over the central reservation, over the carriageway. And then it was like, sort of give us a kind of like a lift up kind of thing.
Nappy.
And it was like, let me see that many aircraft are over here. a Tu-22 blinders. There was a Tu-26 backfire. There was several Mil-8s. There was a couple of Mil-24s, the Heinz, and there was a load of other stuff. And it was they were all ground instructional airframes. So they'd been there for years, apparently. But there was this huge technical school. Which few people in the West obviously knew about. And we certainly didn't know it was there, but it was just one of those things where you stumble across this. And I had to do some real digging after I came back to try and find out about the airframes themselves to put the information in the book. But we caught some kind of pictures of them. And the light was going because it was getting sort of dusk. There were police cars, militias going, driving past, taking a kind of strange interest in what we were doing. Like, one guy on the other guy's shoulders with a camera. Looking back, it was probably not the wisest thing to do.
But they didn't.
Could have
didn't
been hauled off to the nearest police station. I guess.
I know. When I was reading that.
This is the answer, Trip Peter. We'd had all this kind of time. We'd been spoiled by then. We'd been able to go around all these airfields without any kind of you can't do this. There was nowhere really before that we'd been told you can't. There was only a few places where they said you can't walk there, but we could see stuff anyway. Whereas I think we just got a bit blasé about it all. We'll just have a walk down this thing.
Yeah.
Not the best thing looking back, but we were young and daft then.
Wow. Well, you certainly probably couldn't do that today. Let's talk about some of the other airframes that you saw that were quite unusual. As I said, it was almost every chapter, every place you went to, there was something new, something different. What stood out for you?
The Su-15 Flagon, the operational one at Novosibirsk Tolmachevo, we were almost at the end of the ramp tour, and our guide, who was a Soviet-era bureaucrat, had neglected to tell us there was a whole regiment of the things based at the airfield, albeit in another part of the aerodrome, out of sight of the terminal and the passenger area. Anyway, there was this. We're walking around the parking ramp. And there was this absolute howl in the distance. And then from out of nowhere, this Su-15 just taxied in, like, right next to us. The braking parachute got dropped. There was a jeep came out, and the guy got out and picked it up. And the pilot of this Su-15, it was an Su-15 Flagon F for the Conoscenti. It had the particular type of Ogival nose, so I knew what type it was. I'm that kind of a nerd. Anyway, it taxis past. And the pilot it was like this kind of double take. He sees like 40 people with cameras just going, you know, and zooming in on his airplane. And he's like, you know, you almost see like these bulging eyes behind his visor. And he didn't wave. I'm sure he didn't wave, but he was just looking kind of like rather.
What's going on here?
It was a click, 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 click. Thank you very much. But then we couldn't get to the rest of them. Because we asked her, our interpreter, well, where's he going? And there was like, you know, kind of like nothing.
Yeah.
The guy wouldn't be drawn about where they came from, let alone the fact that we couldn't go there. And it was only when we took off from the airfield that we actually saw them parked in this particular part of Tolmachevo. So yeah, it was a bit of a disappointment. Otherwise, we might have seen about another 30 or 40 other things.
And you mentioned that one, Taxi Empire. They weren't all static, were they?
No, that one was operational. It was definitely
you saw a lot of moving stuff.
Part of an interceptor regiment. And I found out subsequently that they were still operating them in that military district. I mean, there were display examples in the museum in Moscow. But they were still in service. And I think at that time, I think the Ukrainians might still have some as well. So I might be wrong on that. But the Russians were definitely still operating them in the operational capacity.
And as you were flying around to these various airports, there were lots of, I don't know, we call them airliners, civilian flights as well, some familiar to Westerners, you know, like the 154s and the 134s.
Yep.
But you saw lots of other aircraft as well. On their I suppose their daily business. What was that like to experience?
It's hard to judge really, because it's a bit like, you know, in the West where you just see scheduled flights. That was their version of them, but these were aircraft that we'd never really seen in any great numbers, sometimes if at all. The Antonov 74, the Kola, the polar version of the Antonov 72, we saw quite a few of those out there. I mean, double figures, let's say. For that's quite good for out there. I'd only ever seen an N-72 or an N-74 at the Paris Air Show. I'd seen a 74 at the Paris Air Show the year before, 1991, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I think it was 89, I can't remember. It was one of those 2 years anyway. And I'm sure I'd seen an N-72 as well at roughly the same time. So I'd actually seen one or two of them, but not in these numbers and certainly not operating on a day-to-day business. So it was quite nice to see them in a different environment and actually seeing them moving and not seeing them in a kind of air show environment. So that was great. And also just being able to get right up to them, you know, and even look inside some of them. It was brilliant. And of course, Antonov 24s, I'd never seen one of those before. They didn't come to, or at least the places where I visited in England. Bearing in mind, I'm from Newcastle, and that's, you know, pretty much where my local kind of aviation experiences were, you know. So I'd never really seen those before then. And then you have other things, so Antonov 26s, Antonov 32s, you know, that we saw quite a lot of those, the different variants of the 24. They were all fairly new. They were all quite new to me as well. But then even the older stuff, Antonov 2s, I'd seen a handful before I went out to Siberia, and then I ended up seeing, you know, several hundred of them out there. But then other types like the Let 29 Delphin, the military jet trainer, because the Soviets didn't build a jet trainer version of their own. They basically, you know, sort of like farmed that out to the Warsaw Pact countries. The Czechs built the jet trainers, on all the Poles, that they both built jet trainer types for the Soviet Air Force. So, you know, they were quite nice to see. And then, of course, the other Let type was the 410, the Turbolet. I'd been to Hungary and Czechoslovakia just a few days before I went out to Siberia. And we'd been around the factory in Czechoslovakia, as it was then, where they built the aircraft. And there was about 40 Aeroflot examples in full livery and markings, which the Russians hadn't paid for because of the fall of the Soviet Union. So they'd never been delivered. They were still sitting around outside the factory and they were never going to go anywhere. And of course, because of the ramifications of the fall of the Soviet Empire and the fact that they had no money to pay for anything, the aircraft that had been delivered, they couldn't get spares for them anymore. So one by one, they were basically just being parked up and robbed for spares. So everywhere we went in Siberia, you'd come across them, that Let 410 or more, most of which were out of commission because they'd had engines or propellers or other bits of airframe taken away from them. And to fit, you know, it was a cannibalization for the ones that could keep flying. There was a few that were still flying, but not many. And that was situation was only going to get worse. So we saw, you know, 100 or so, or at least 100 of those in various states. And you go to an airfield, let's say Yakutsk-Magan, for instance, the smaller airfield in Yakutsk, and there'll be 7 or 8 of them line up with no engines, you know, just in the line.
And you mentioned earlier, we mentioned the use of bribes to oil the wheels. You had to call that winning quite seriously. I mean, throughout the book, you talk about people dropping a few packs of Marlboro or a bottle of champagne or whatever to get to see a bit of an airfield that was closed or whatever. But at one point, you were actually, not you, the group was in a bit of trouble, wasn't it?
Yeah. We got stiffed at Yakutsk. We'd left the EL-18 at Yakutsk to fly with a chartered An-24 up to the Arctic Ocean, to Chersky. And it was only for one night. So we were up there, you know, one day, we came back down the next day. But when we get back, the aircraft was, the EL-18 had been impounded. And the airport authorities were basically demanding money from us. So, and this had all been agreed beforehand, apparently, you know, it was, like aircraft didn't pay landing fees as far as we were concerned, and we'd been told there wouldn't be a problem. And yet when we got back, they were requesting, I think it was the equivalent of something like $70 from each of us. And they were, bear in mind, there was like 40 odd people on the trip, plus the, you know, the crew and everybody else. It was a considerable amount of money. Luckily, we had it. A few people were actually short of the money, and, you know, other people pitched in to help out. So we did actually raise the money in the end to pay it. We did have to pay it. But there were some serious negotiations going on in the background and some kind of like heated discussions with our tour organizer and our interpreter. And I think maybe one or two of the fixers might have got involved. I'm not privy to all the details because it went on behind closed doors. Basically, what happened was they went off to try and argue the toss with the airport authorities. And in the meantime, the airport authorities said, look, you can have a walk around the airfield again. You know, when we won't stop you this time, because we made it a bit difficult when we had the official tour. And there was some argy-bargy with the guy who took us around. He was quite officious. And we had to use a bus to get off. And then the bus had to go like 50 yards down the tarmac. And we had to get off again to take a picture of an aircraft. Then get back on again to go 50 yards to the next air. It was that kind of deal. Whereas this time round, I think they wanted to say, look, you know, we're going to be a bit magnanimous this time. We'll let you do this on your own terms, but we want the money. And I think that's why they relented. And so we just walked off around the airfield for like 3 or 4 hours or something, while these guys basically argued in a room with the Russians going, "Niet," kind of thing. And that was how it worked. And at the end of the day, we still had to pay the $70 each. So
Yeah, to get yourselves out.
Exactly. Could have been worse, though. You know, they could have just said, look, you're not having the aircraft. You know, find your own way home. So you know, all things considered, we weren't put in prison. We weren't put in a police cell. You know, we're not working in a Siberian salt mine. We're still, you know, we managed to get home. So, you know, it's all good.
So tell us about a bit more generally about some of the experiences. What was the food like, the lodgings? I mean, I know the aircraft was where you often ate.
Yeah.
But hotels.
Hotels were interesting.
Yeah.
They went from fair to awful. So the place in Northern Base were turned up, had cockroaches, which is probably built standard for there, but they had some weird shower arrangements that didn't work. The hotels from the Soviet era, and this is the one in Moscow we're staying in, I'm talking about now, there was no, the lift wouldn't stop at the first floor where the restaurant was. Because the idea was if you were in your rooms above that, you had to come down to the lobby, walk through the lobby and up a flight of stairs to get your meals, because the KGB miners and the watchers would sit in nice armchairs in the lobby waiting for people to come out of their rooms and go for a meal, or to go out and get their passport, to leave their passports behind and walk out to wherever they want to go for it to walk around. So they could monitor them much easier than if they were coming straight from the hotel room to go and eat. And of course, once they went to go and eat, their room was free, wasn't it? So they could go bug it or go through the stuff and all the rest of it. And that's how it used to work. And every floor of the major hotels in Russia would have a concierge, like a cleaner or somebody looked after it. But actually, they were a KGB informer as well. So the story goes. So there was all this kind of like strange interplay, you know, that went on. But I actually got invited into the concierge's office. I ended up speaking English with a 10, 11, 12-year-old daughter or something, or she might have been a bit older, I can't remember now. But I was helping her with her English one night. You know, it was this kind of strange arrangement. It was really, it was really weird.
The food wasn't great, was it? The
food wasn't great at all. Half the time we didn't know what it was. And even sometimes requests to find out what it was fell on deaf ears. And the rest of the time it was probably shouldn't find out what this is, which is eat it. So the in-flight catering on the L18 wasn't too bad, actually. You know, there were proper meals served. They had a galley where they could prepare stuff in a limited fashion. But on the N24, it was the pre-packaged stuff. And it was probably Aeroflot stuff as well that they obviously managed to buy in from somewhere. And it was that you got like this kind of slab of meat. Well, presume it was meat. That's what it looked like and tasted like. But it was foil wrapped and you couldn't tell what it was. And then you had some other stuff that was kind of shrink wrapped as well. And it was edible, but that was about it. And it was quite tasteless a lot of the time and it was quite colorless a lot of the time. The fruit juice. It might as well have just been coloured ink for the kind of taste it had.
Yeah,
and it had a very weird taste as well. It didn't taste like orange juice or apple juice. I've heard that about China as well, where they would put actually coloured inks in juice and call it fruit juice. And it might be the same kind of deal. And yet you would go to little stalls occasionally. People have little wooden kind of stalls where they sell stuff. And you get the weird stuff. Like you'd be able to find Milky Way bars that had been packaged in Holland, or cans of Coors, which had been canned in Germany or Denmark or somewhere. You know, how the hell they'd got these stuff across there? Who knows?
Yeah.
But you could buy this stuff, you know, occasionally. So you found some weird stuff in various little shacks around some of these cities. So, yeah, it was a very strange kind of contrast between this bland food and stuff that you were quite familiar with, albeit in a very strange area.
Yeah. And when you arrived back from Siberia into Moscow, you had a day, I think it was a day in Moscow. You saw some interesting sights there, some international airframes from
Libya and also Equatorial Guinea.
Was that the one where the security guard?
Yeah, there was the Equatorial Guinea Antonov 32 that was parked up. I think it was undergoing repair. It was on a remote part of the airfield at Bykovo, it was. And yeah, it had a security guard, an armed guard, and he wouldn't let anybody near the airplane. And even our tour guide, who was this really old chap, he might have been in the Great Patriotic War, you know, World War II. He had a kind of so many medals on his tunic that he was almost like leaning over to one side, you know, with the weight of them. And they had an argument basically. And, you know, sort of like told this guy where to go, but he wasn't having any of it sort of thing. So we basically had to photograph this aircraft from a distance. But yeah, it was just one of those things. And it was one of the few occasions where we were told, look, you can't do this, you can't do that. The other bit, which you're probably alluding to as well, was at Myshekovo, which is another airfield around the outskirts of Moscow. And this is where almost the entire fleet of Antonov 30s, the Klenks, the survey version of the N-24, were based or parked up for lack of spares. And one aircraft, which if I give the number, it might give the game away, which is 30055, had been involved in the air sampling of the radiation after the Chernobyl incident in 1986. So it had been after the mission. It was obviously irradiated, the airframe, and they had to park it somewhere. Yeah. So they parked it in Myshekovo. And when they did, you know, after a few days, the grass underneath where they parked it turned yellow with the radiation, you know. When we got there, so this was 1992, so this was 6 years later, the risk had gone down a little bit, but it was still sufficiently deemed dangerous that we couldn't go anywhere near it. So basically, when we had this little briefing before we turned up on the airfield, when they said where we could go and where we couldn't go, the major thing they said, look, you know, just don't go anywhere near the aircraft. It wasn't fenced off or anything, and it didn't look any different from any other aircraft. There weren't any signs to say, look, you know, it's highly dangerous or anything. It was just parked in next to a few other Antonov 30s. That was it. But it was pretty lethal. You know, if you got near it, if you touched it, chances are you would know about it, you know, sort of thing. So
yeah,
it was plenty dangerous.
Wow. Okay. Well, listen, I think we've given a flavour of the trip, of what you've seen, but there's so much more in the book. As I said, fascinating airframe stories, history, and everything else that you could imagine on such a unique trip. But Graham, where can we find the book and you online?
Okay, well, the best place probably to order it if you want to read it is on Amazon. So if you look, if you just search my name on Amazon, then it'll come up there. There is I do have a website, but I don't really sort of like, you know, maintain it much. So you're best off looking through Amazon.
Okay. Now, there's a difference between the Kindle or the soft copy version and the hard copy version, isn't there?
Yeah, unfortunately, with the kind of limitations and the cost implications of getting a kind of full color version of the book, the photographs in the printed versions are black and white for obvious reasons. Whereas if you buy the Kindle version, the formatting's not great because Kindle's not really set up as a kind of like a picture book, if you like. But the photographs are in color in the Kindle version. But don't be surprised if sometimes the pictures are slightly missized because of where they appear on a page. You can obviously muck around with the settings to get them to come up full size. It's not a perfect arrangement, unfortunately. Kindle's basically set up to be like more text than pictures.
Yeah. Well, I did break a rule and get the Kindle version. I was really glad that I did, because I did get to see the color pictures. And we have to put it into context. These are traditional photos of
the slides that were scanned.
Slides and scanned. So, you know, color and an image, there is a bit of a transfer there, but some great photos, and that alone is worth getting. But also, just before we leave you, Graham, you've since we last spoke, two more books you've published, From Aerodrome to Aerials, the history of Anthorn Airfield. So I do feel like I might be coming back to talk to you about that, because I think there's some Fleet Air Arm history in that, isn't there?
A lot of Fleet Air Arm history there, yes.
Yeah, so I think we might come back to that. And another book on UAP as well, Aerial UFO Encounters 53 to 54.
Intercept and Identify, it's called, yeah.
Yeah. So you've been busy. What next? Anything else on the radar?
So I also finished a book called County Durham Aviation Stories, which the first volume of that was out. So that's like, you know, various stories about crashes and some other events that happen in the county I now live in, because I now live in Weardale in Northern England. And I'm actually writing the second volume for that series. But I'm also writing the 55-56 book about UFO encounters, or the aerial encounters with UFOs, so from pilots and aircrew point of view. So yeah, pretty busy. And I'm also trying to work on a follow-up for the Foo Fighters book of World War II that I wrote.
Okay.
Because I found some more information in the archives, in the National Archives. So yeah, busy
so
boy.
Busy. Well, Graham, as always, really, really fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Peter. It's been great to be back. Thank you very much.
That's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts, as well as the wider extended family of supporters, including Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian and Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club. We know you're really busy, but thousands of you listening, and we'd love to get your feedback, either Apple Podcasts or Spotify or in your individual podcast player. Do engage with us on social media as well. And if you'd like to make a donation to support our running costs, please look at our donation details on the website. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Gareth and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. And that's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Graham.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear.
programs produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.